All right, well, welcome back to Local Christendom. This is episode 2, and this is a follow-up with Keith Darrell on your travels, your evangelism and preaching tour across the United States. So Keith, catch us up. Where have you been over the last couple months? What's new?
Yeah, so I started off in Southern California. I did get to spend a week in Hawaii, which was kind of nice. I had it was raining in Southern California for a week, and so I always felt like I need to justify the trip. It was only like a $270 round trip to go to Hawaii, and I slept in the back of a minivan. So I feel like I'm not like living some luxurious lifestyle and going over to Hawaii. But that was actually a really good the students in Hawaii were just very humble. They're really kind. I really enjoyed getting over there, and I kind of really want to go back just because, yeah, they did kind of just have a different vibe than kind of mainland Americans in a way. So that was really good. And then, yeah, largely Southern California, Central California, and then I kind of made a little run through the South. Weather's been really bad this fall or this spring. So it's kind of a lot of my plans have been nudged. And so, like, I had to drop south. I was going to preach in the Midwest. I had to drop down to Mississippi, drop down to Arkansas. The furthest east I got was Indiana. I preached at Indiana University on Monday, and then I was in Arkansas, and I'm going to head to Colorado, and then Montana, and then Washington, Oregon, and then California again to finish the semester.
Okay, so in terms of topics that are getting a crowd, what has been the main talking points that are people are resonating with right now?
Yeah, kind of the main there's kind of a twofold thing that people are genuinely seem to engage on. Obviously, sex is, I mean, it's 90% of the issues, you know what I mean, and especially people that age. So I don't remember if we talked about this last time, but kind of building off of the concept of consent, that'll just kind of be my open-ended question could kind of start the thing. You know, here we are at such and such university, and what your campus wants is for you to have legal sex, not necessarily moral sex. So they give you the idea that consent is the way to get you to legal sex, but what they're not giving you is moral sex. And so that kind of, you know, it's funny. People just hear the word consent and they think that you reject it and therefore you're promoting rape or sexual violence in some regard. And so that's been kind of the impetus for a lot of discussion. And then the other thing is trans has been a little bit more reasonable than, say, semesters past. It's I first noticed that last fall that I felt like there was almost like the exhaustion limit with it. So I don't know if that's culture-wide. I'm not sure if it's staying power or not. But I feel like I've been able to say certain things regarding trans that, say, a year and a half ago, even 2019, right before COVID, you couldn't get away with. And so those have kind of been the two main topics. And then the other thing, again, related to sexuality is pornography. And what's been really interesting to me on that point in general is the men seem generally exhausted with it, but women kind of boast in pornography and stuff like that. So it's kind of an interesting flex point right now. And I'm still trying to diagnose the guys because I've been really impressed with how I don't know. Just it's almost like they all know it's destructive of them. You know what I mean? And so, but they're entangled in it. And it is like, how do I get out? I know there's shame. There was a young man at Mississippi State, and he was just like, not a Christian, but he's just like, I just feel so gross. I'm disgusted with myself, and blah blah blah. So he has somewhat of a conscience. You know what I mean? A deep conscience that, yeah, this is destructive. It's not right. And yet he's a slave. How does he get out of it? So, those have kind of been the main, tier. There hasn't been much politics, back in 2016, particularly 2020, obviously I was not on campus due to COVID, so I didn't get the political vibe. That's probably been one of the more interesting things is like even that, maybe I should just say exhaustion seems to be the key for everybody. It just seems like nobody has a stomach for Trump or Biden. Nobody has a stomach for just a lot of things. So I just feel like exhaustion might be a pretty good summary term.
Hmm. Now, in terms of if those are the kind of problems or hot cultural issues, what have been truths from Scripture or certain passages of Scripture that you feel like for those who do have an ear to hear, they're open to hearing, here's the solution to this trans problem or the porn problem or whatever.
Yeah, the I'm still trying to work through these categories. So there is a book that came out called Bad Therapy by a woman named Abigail Schreier. And she wrote a previous book that I did not read that was on kind of transgenderism, transing our girls or something like that. And so she's basically has written a book on how, like, you have a generation of people who have grown up with a therapeutic. And in thinking that we're going to help them with the therapeutic, we're actually exhausting anxiety, depression. We're pushing those out to the limits. And so one of the things that was interesting, and you know, even when you're preaching and you start to use certain words and you're like, okay, what gains traction? So maybe about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, I was looking for something on Francis Schaeffer and LaBrie on YouTube. So I hopped on, saw a link to something, I click on it and just literally jump like 5 minutes into the clip. And this girl's kind of reading a poem, and I think it was to her parents. She just says, I told you I wanted to be happy. When you heard me say happiness, you thought I meant hedonism. And maybe I was using the word happiness wrong, because what I meant was wholeness. And so I was like, that's kind of a good word is wholeness. And so that's kind of been a word that I've been using in the description of, you feel disjointed, the world's fractured, blah, blah, blah. And the goal is, how do we make you whole? And that's been kind of the thing that seems to kind of have some sort of traction with people. And one of the ways that really stood out, that kind of the first time I used that on campus, was this young girl we're going back and forth on kind of pornography, and she starts off with kind of like, yeah, I can agree it's kind of bad, but you can do it ethically. That's usually the move, is right now the way we use it, because we're not an egalitarian society, but if once we get to this egalitarian pornographic era, then it's going to be really moral. And I maintain why I still think that it's going to be an immoral system. And I just remember kind of going back and forth with her, and I don't remember exactly how I got there, but I remember saying to her, but the goal in this is not just to, like, you know, beat you up morally or something like that. It's like, how do we get you back to being a whole woman? And she almost just started crying right off the bat, and she just paused and, like, stares at me for a good 30 seconds. And it's like, I have to go. I have to go. And it was kind of crushing in a way, because you just kind of felt like, here's this concept of wholeness clearly resonates with her, but she doesn't know where to go with it. You know what I mean? Now she was just kind of like taken aback. And so that was kind of probably one of the main things I've been pursuing as we start to have these conversations. And I wish I remember our previous conversation better, because tied into that, I've been stealing something. I'm afraid to tell people I've been reading the Pope, but the Pope has a book, The Theology of the Body. And there were this series of lectures from the early 80s that he gave. And I've just kind of been building out of that. I'm trying to get at is when we begin with creation to people, like if you just begin with sin to a culture that's kind of chaotic, it makes God sound like arbitrary. It just kind of comes in as being like, especially in a therapeutic age where they've been, you know, in their heads, real or perceived, they've been hurt or harmed rather than a willful transgression. But if you begin with creation, I feel like oftentimes Reformed people don't want to say, no, you are worth loving. You know what I mean? Like, you're made in the image of God. Whereas we want to be like, oh, we're not worth anything. And there's a, you know, there can be a grain of truth to that. But when you begin with that place, it kind of ends up kind of, I feel like, turning creation on its head. And so anyway, what the Pope did in that book and what he's seeking to lay out is, from the beginning, it was not so. So in everything I'm trying to interact with people, it's beginning with the goodness of creation and then how we've ruptured it downstream. And so your lack of wholeness, your lack of, even if you're depressed, all these sorts of things, that's all downstream from the good creation that's been ruptured. And so that's been the main point of contact I've been trying to use. And I just feel like it's amazing how disarming, almost in a way, it is to so many people. Like, instead of like, criticize our circle, instead of pressing the antithesis, it's kind of like, you do have a concept of what is good, and you do have a concept of what is right, and you do want happiness. And so the question is, you know, how do you achieve those things? And reading some kind of like even marginal Aquinas stuff, I'm no immersed there by any stretch of the imagination, but kind of that strand of natural law has actually made so many conversations so much easier, rather than trying to press an antithesis where they shut down, if that makes sense. And so I feel like pressing that Vantillian antithesis shuts down so many conversations, whereas now just kind of taking, even just granting, like, yeah, we all want happiness. How do we get there? And then the gospel coming in through that means, and we were made to be happy. We were made to be loved. We were made to love other people, but we've ruptured that. And that's where sin, and I feel like they are keenly sensitive to how our sin harms other people, because they're therapeutic. And so, you know, my sin hurt other people have hurt me. So they are keenly aware of that. So when I tease out sin in the context of how it's damaged you and you have damaged others, I just feel like that's kind of my inroads.
Hmm. Was there a difference? You mentioned the people in Hawaii having a bit of a different take than, as you said, the mainlanders. could you just draw out what were some of the differences you've noticed regionally on some of these issues?
Yeah. So I would say in general, the kids in Hawaii were pretty just humble, and maybe it's just because they never get a preacher. And so it was just kind of like, what do we do? You know what I mean? They just kind of sat there and listened, and like, it was almost felt like a marginal celebrity at the end of one day where they're like, can we have a picture? Can we have a picture with you? And so it was more like, yeah. So I think it was like a little bit like, what do we do with this? And maybe it was just because I was a white guy and maybe I don't see that many white guys. I don't know. Just kidding. But California is actually broken up almost like even on the coast of California, you have Orange County, which is relatively conservative. And so I feel like when I'm preaching in Orange County, I have there's almost it's not the Bible Belt by any means, but there is almost just like a broad conservatism that's in Orange County. It's not as liberal as like if you're an outsider that you're thinking of California. But if you get to like the Central Coast, which I think voting wise is pretty conservative, all the students are kind of potheads. It's you get to like UC Santa Barbara, very promiscuous campus. Honestly, I'm there and they're literally flashing me like while I'm preaching and things like that. And so it's just very and you walk on that campus and you just feel like some sort of Dionysian culture much more than a lot of other campuses. And then you get into the South, you still kind of have vibes of the Bible Belt. And that's starting to change quite a bit, but spending some time in Arkansas, spending some time in Mississippi, I actually really enjoyed those places this time because you kind of have that strand of cultural Christianity where they still have a conscience. Jesus is still important. They don't really know the challenges. They don't really know the gospel, but they think they do. And probably one of the things that stood out the most being in the South was, no offense to my Baptist friends, but like that Baptist culture that, that is all centered on salvation. I met with a guy the other day and he'd start talking. He's like, oh, you know, we had like 500 people show up and, you know, there are 39 salvations. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like this very, even though I'm doing evangelism all the time, I'm not thinking in terms of like, oh yeah, bless you, I see that hand. Bless you, I see that hand. And they very much had that. And a kid came up to me at the end of the day and he was asking questions because he had a kid, a friend of his that was involved in the church. Now he's living with his girlfriend. He hasn't come to church anymore. He's like, oh, what do we do? And I was like, well, have you talked to him? He's like, yeah, I have. And I was like, well, have the elders talked to him? And he looked at me like I was cross-eyed. You know what I mean? Like, elders? What do you mean elders? Like, but and he wanted the whole discussion to be once saved, always saved. He's like, well, is he still saved? I was like, I don't know the kid. I can't say if he's saved or not. But he wanted this whole, and I'm just not used to this once saved, always saved discussion. So like getting into the South, I really enjoyed it because students really listened to me. They're really respectful, but then what you had was much more almost like shibboleths that you had to overcome, that like they just have these certain ideas in their head, and if you're pushing on them a little bit, it's like, well, do you believe that you're saved? Can you lose your salvation? And like, I'm just not used to that conversation right off the bat. And so that was probably one of the differences. And then in the Midwest, I would just say I kind of think the students are broadly pretty humble. Again, they're kind of nice Midwestern people. But yeah, there's not a radical gap, I don't feel like, spiritually necessarily between the Midwest and the South. I do see that in California quite a bit. Your Orange County, your Central Coast, the spiritually, they're just pagans. They're like full tilt. Yeah, kind of Dionysian. I would not be surprised if not involved in, you know, if it was available, there would be temple prostitution in California. You know what I mean? Like in strands of that, you just kind of feel like it's because they want spirituality. That's why they're at the beach. They're smoking pot. They want the oneness of everything. That'd probably be the main place where I feel like there's a big cultural shift for me.
Hmm. So you mentioned this need or feeling for wholeness, or just there's this innate sense of pornography, whether you think you are the one exploiting or being exploited, in both cases, there's something, you know, Paul talks about sexual sins being sins against your own body, right? Mm-hmm. There's something that even people who don't have a Christian worldview, they know that there's something that it takes from them, whether they're the one on the screen or the one in front of the screen. And I think last time we talked, we mentioned the gospel element of Christ as the healer being mm-hmm. one of these emphases. When you mentioned the lack of wholeness, it makes me think of that, you know, the Hebrew shalom, and what there's this certain kind of creational return to Eden, naked and unashamed, that all of us have that kind of memory. Mm-hmm. Of there should be a nakedness that is unashamed, and you don't really experience that until you have perhaps a healthy marriage, for one, like a healthy Christian marriage. And even within marriage, there can be certain kinds of shame that you have to overcome from your past or whatever. So I just find that really interesting, that this seems to be a great craving and desire that is now at least being verbalized. I think it's strange that at least even 10 years ago, going to therapy was something that was like not necessarily mainstream or like cool. But now this whole therapeutic thing is like, oh, everyone has a therapist.
Yeah. And my pills, you know what I mean? And my medications or whatever. Yeah. And it's almost like a badge of honor. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just interested to hear your observations on that trend and change from, there's a sense in which, I don't want to admit, or once upon a time, it seemed like people would not want to admit certain deficiencies in themselves. Mm-hmm. Whereas now this is the whole cult of victimhood. There's a certain sense in which the shame of needing help has now been kind of thrown off. Mm-hmm. And then there's a negative side to that, but then there's also some of the positive side where certain people are just willing to own, no, this actually really is screwing me up. And then you have to discern between like the true victims and the people who are just using that as a cloak for their sin.
Yeah. And I think in the sinfulness of our culture, that you have this weird dance where in one sense, mental health and all this sort of stuff, I have all these sorts of things. But if you lean in and you push, yeah, perhaps that's why you're behaving this way. How dare you use my shame against me? You know what I mean? So it's very much how they want to use it on their own terms. So if they want to tell you, oh, I was abused, blah, blah, blah. All right. Well, if you're abused, all this sort of stuff, and it's really messed up mentally, maybe you should call a timeout for making decisions right now and get some outside in. How dare you use that? You know what I mean? So it's actually in some ways a protectivism. It sounds very honest. It sounds very humble, but also becomes a place of pride as well. And so I think that's where, and I need to think this through more, I need to read Abigail Schreier's Bad Therapy book to, cause I think she lays out some of the stuff, but like trying to get at that point, I think is one of the keys is it still a protective mechanism of actually not dealing with things. So like when I was in seminary, I had a friend of mine who's involved in deep darkness. He'd always hide behind total depravity. So it sounded very humble and my sin and da, 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 but he actually wasn't willing to deal with any of his sin that he was practically doing on the ground. Everything was kind of an abstract theory. So that's how I feel oftentimes with these people now, the therapeutics that you kind of cover yourself with your medication, you cover yourself with all the therapeutic language, but you're not really looking to repent. You're not really looking to make restitution to the persons you've harmed and stuff like that. So there's a goodness to it, like you were saying, because there is like that element of shame, even like Adam and Eve covering themselves and trying to run from the garden. You're like, that's not the answer. But at the same time, there is a shame. So how do we properly address that? And I think we're still at that place where the subtle irony of there's almost like the exposing yourself is still a type of covering, even though it has the cultural appearance of like, man, so much vulnerability. And it's like, they're not vulnerable at all. You know what I mean? It's pure protection. And this is maybe on a little bit of a different side. I think of a young woman I was interacting with a couple years ago at Montana State, who you could tell all of her preemptive strikes against me was she had like piercings on her face and green hair, and everything she was saying to me was a preemptive strike of like, well, I'm going to get you to reject me first. And I just kind of remember making the comment to her. I was like, you can't get me to reject you. And it was kind of like totally let down her guard, because you could just tell like her whole life has been, all right, I'm rejected. If I get out in front of this guy and just say, oh, I'm so broken and you're going to think I'm this, but I'm blah, blah, blah. And just kind of like, you're not going to win means not the right word. You're not going to manipulate me with that language in the sense that therefore I'm going to like, yeah, I'm going to reject you. I'll persevere in this discussion. And so I think that's one of the things we have to realize, that people are using kind of the therapeutic for at a certain level of protection mechanism, and it's actually destroying them more than it's actually helping. So it's a really weird dance, and how you get in there and uncover what's really going on. I'll just use my friend as an illustration again. Like, uncovering total depravity for what you're actually, the sins you're actually committing, rather than just an abstract, totally depraved sort of person. So these people with the therapeutic, I think the challenge that we have is overcoming and getting into specifics and them actually willing to admit, like, yeah, this has messed me up. I am involved in these things, not just from a, you're a victim of your environment, but you're also just using your environment and your experiences as an excuse for your own bitterness, your own anger, your own resentment. So, I think that's difficult. I don't think I've locked into exactly what that is, but that's probably the thing I've noticed the most is if they can tell me all day long about all their traumas, but if I say, hey, maybe your trauma's dictating, then they just get really mad and protective. So it's a weird humility amidst pride.
Do you have any observations on some of the generational sins? So this is with college students, you're seeing that front and center, but of course I know you're aware of what's going on with millennials and Gen Xers and the boomers and stuff. I would just be interested to hear if you have any reflections on some of those differences in felt needs or stated objections to Christianity and how that differs amongst some of the different age groups that you are interacting with or are noticing.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I can't remember our last conversation well, so I might be repeating myself, but kind of a regular theme I've had probably over the past year-ish is one thing that's interesting. I almost never interact with an atheist nowadays. It's almost the presupposition. You're dealing much more with, if God's a creator and we're in this world system and he's the creator, didn't he create the world system? And therefore, can he be trusted? Is he good? That if the world is bad, isn't he the cause? So I feel like very rarely with these young people, do I have a debate over materialism? It's almost like they all know, what's the best way to put it? So like with the rise of critical theory, one of the good things about critical theory, is that it kind of acknowledges that we're not just these white lab coat enlightenment people studying the world very objectively and stuff like that, but we're doing most of our work in terms of our values. And so all these people are heavily value laden in everything that they're doing. So they are moral absolutists in ways that like we might think that they're relativists and all this sort of stuff, but they're like, oh no, they're the most dogmatic moral absolutists, and the lightest infraction that you make, be it verbally, be it sexually, whatever it is, I mean, it's judgment upon judgment time. So one of the good things, yeah, these young people, they're heavily valuated, which I think facilitates a life of Christianity, because like the world's pressed through with values. We're dealing with a personal world, not an impersonal. We're not in a scientific world, and I think that's a good thing. The world is full of values. And I think that's in many ways, a good place to be. The challenge with that becomes when there is, say, systemic abuses and there is a creator God, what's his relationship to those systemic abuses? And how does his sovereignty, how does his authority over all these things play in? So much more of my apologetic is almost centered on the problem of evil more than ever before. And it's not just an intellectual thing. It's a very like they feel the values. It's not just like Bertrand Russell being like, oh, if there's, you know, whatever, if God's all good and all powerful, and, you know, why is there evil in the world? It's not just a logical thing. It's, you know, look at the world around us. It's clearly broken. Where's God at in this? And in some ways it's easy, and in some ways it's difficult, because, you know, in some ways God's hidden in it and we don't understand God's providence. And all through the scriptures, they're often wrestling with God, where are you? Why aren't you acting on our behalf and all that sort of stuff? So, I think it actually frees us up quite a bit with a lot of the younger people, that they're richly imbued with values. The problem is they're all pagan. All their values are dead wrong. Like we really don't have a, kind of going back to the antithesis point, there's almost not anything we can agree with. But on the bright side, even when I'm out there preaching, one of my most common things is like, look, I don't care if you're right wing, left wing, conservative, blah, blah, blah. Like everybody out here wants love. And it's like, yeah. And so like, start with the big platitudes: compassion, grace, mercy. Now the question becomes, now what is that? You know what I mean? So like, and not just leaving it at this abstract level of everybody wants to be loved, but like, now what is that love? And what is God like? And even the other day at Indiana, I was really just kind of pressing that point home. And it was interesting because there was one thing that's been interesting as a side, and I haven't figured this out yet. handful of the trans people I meet, they're all named after astrological bodies. It's like Neptune and Pluto. Like they changed their names to that. And so I can't remember Luna at Indiana University the other day. And prior to that, I was at Arkansas. It was Neptune. But even like that, there's like paganism going on back here that they're being named after these astral bodies. It's not just in a vacuum that these things are happening. And just very much laying out, like, here's what God is like. Here's what God is like. He is loving. He is gracious. But what should his love do with evil? So anyway, that's probably been one of the things to me that's probably the most interesting was them raising much more the objection. It's almost like they grant God exists, but he's against us. And it is kind of that satanic lie that Yahweh is a curmudgeon in heaven. And, you know, I'm the liberator. He's giving you all these bad commands and I'm the liberator. And so there is I honestly don't know how spiritual warfare all unfolds, but it is almost like a satanic open season. Just the pride, the blasphemy, the stuff that I hear is much more because when you have a land of values and you think that your values are right, it's prone towards self-righteousness. And when they're antithetical to Yahweh's, there's almost like satanic power behind it. His kingdom of darkness is value laden. And I think that's kind of where the American people are at. So in some ways it's helpful, in other ways it's hurtful.
Yeah. It's interesting. So obviously the demons know who the one God is and are the spirit of Antichrist, spirit of wickedness is anti Jesus Christ, like anti the true God. And so there's a certain sense in which they all are aiming those lies at the God that you are coming and representing and preaching. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on some of the projection that's going on there? And you mentioned this kind of like felt problem of evil. When I've interacted with people who have that felt, where is God or his absence, or they're angry at him, I feel like 9 times out of 10, it's connected with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing in terms of how people are people disowning their parents? I'm seeing that a lot myself these days. Are the parents being kind of God's scapegoat? That's another common one where, mm-hmm. you know, made up abuse.
Yeah. yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right. That is, it is like parents are the scapegoat. Yeah. A couple things, like me being a bleeping white male, I'm one of the chief scapegoats. You know what I mean? It was even kind of fun. When I was preaching at UC Santa Barbara, and my day was going well, so I almost said something, but I didn't. But I could hear a young black woman over my shoulder saying, why are we centering a white voice? Why are we centering a white voice? And I almost wanted to turn around and be like, hey, welcome, Martin Luther King. You know what I mean? But I was like, you know, I just keep sticks. Things are going well. Just ignore it and keep pressing forward. So like, yeah, obviously the white guys in general are the scapegoat. And then from there, kind of more relationally, it is like their parents. And even one of the things that gives you a chance to preach, which has been interesting, is even getting after that component of being willing to say that what the grace of God enables you to do is even to forgive those who have hurt you. And like probably one of the main things probably over the past year and a half, I feel like my preaching has been far more personal or pointed in that sense of just very particularly, here's what your sins are doing to hurt one another. Even if people have hurt you, is there a way forward where you can forgive them, or you just have to live in a land of bitterness, all that? And so being much more pointed, I think, in that sort of stuff, opposed to just kind of like a broad stream apologetic, I think has been helpful in communicating to these people, because it's been surprising how many girls, particularly more so than I can think of guys' faces as I'm preaching and I'll make that comment, they'll often be like, you can just kind of see it in their face where it is like a reality of like, yeah, can I forgive that person? You know, and the hard part is obviously like real or perceived abuses. I think I grew up at a time where, I think the culture I grew up in, if it was happening today, we'd be like, oh, I was abused growing up, where we're just kind of like, oh no, you just got spanked a lot. You know what I mean? And it wasn't always righteous, spankings. You know what I mean? It wasn't always a restraint. And these kids take it much more as like, oh yeah, this was clearly harm, but that's kind of, as Abigail Schreier would say that that's basically the rise of the therapeutic is the minute you get somebody saying, oh, this has damaged you, this has damaged you, you start to lean in more and more on that kind of component of things. So the young people, they definitely have that. But yeah, it goes back to the gospel, that that healing, can it actually reconcile with your parents? And it is kind of like, yeah, where the rubber hits the road, because they don't want it. They don't want to forgive. And that, that kind of goes back to that therapeutic dynamic where they want to have been harmed, and they want to be able to treat it on their own terms in a way. You know what I mean? And so there's a certain level of consistency. I need to think it through more. But yeah, that protective mechanism, parents hurt me. All right, can you forgive them? That's almost not really the dialogue. They want it to be almost like a permanent stain. They would never say that, but it almost becomes a permanent out at any point. Whereas what the gospel does is make you address those things and doesn't give you a permanent out in bitterness and resentment and stuff like that. And that's one of the beauties of the gospel, but it's also one of the difficulties, I think, in interacting with them, that no, this is what's required of you in the gospel, is forgive those who've harmed you.
Hmm. In your preaching, are you noticing, is there a gender, if you look at your crowds that you're getting or the people you're interacting, how much more is it resonating with males versus females, and who's your interlocutor and some of in the majority of your showdowns?
Yeah, you know what, to be honest, I feel like it's still pretty split. Girls might be the mild dominant. I'm trying, there's been some really fun days, and I think girls have kind of down it's been interesting, because like I said earlier, sexuality comes up a lot, and so they're kind of like the most vociferous on that, as if because it's almost like I do think there's an element where they've been sold a bill of goods, and they have to convince themselves that it's not a bill of goods. You know? And so like the guys, it's all right for a guy to be promiscuous, so he doesn't have to be ramped up and defend promiscuity in a certain way. But a woman, amidst all of her contentions that she's empowered and she's liberated from it, she knows she's full of it. So they have a tendency to still be pushing back a little bit the hardest on certain conversations in certain categories. And what I've discovered even is, I think there's a whole ministry to be had, actually, as I'm thinking about this. Some of this is off the cuff, so I'm thinking through. Men in general have been very humble this semester, I would say. And I can even think of certain men who are sitting on stairs. I wish I could remember his name. He had a Hispanic name, and he listened to like 3 or 4 hours. He left, came back, and he made a comment. I think what he ended up having was a daughter out of wedlock, and like a little girl, because he asked me a question. He's like, you made a comment earlier about, you know, girls without fathers, you know, and promiscuity and stuff like that. And I was like, well, I didn't say every girl who doesn't have it. But I was like, and he's like, so what do you recommend a father does? It's like, well, she needs, like, can't remember. I kind of gave 3 P's. She needs your presence, she needs your protection, and she needs your provision. I think I kind of gave something along those lines. And, but one of the main things she needs is your presence, that you're consistent, you're faithful. She knows you're reliable, blah, blah, blah. And you could just tell the nature of his questions were all very sincere. Then being in Mississippi, being in Arkansas, and these young men asking questions about how can I free myself from pornography and stuff like that. So I would say women have probably been the dominant driver and the dominant discussion point. But as I think about it, very particularly, and I think of my crowds who are sitting there, you're like, so many young men are very humble, and I do think that there is a harvest to be had amongst young men with some clarity of voice on clear moral issues and clear call, like even just trying to encourage them to, things that we talk about, take dominion, be fruitful, love, serve, honor, those sorts of things, I just feel like are very straightforward. So I would say that girls are the most mouthy, but the guys, I feel like generally they've engaged me, but they've been pretty, I would say, pretty humble and attentive to the message so far.
Hmm. Well, give us a little preview of what your travels are going to be over the next few weeks, getting into the end of the school year, and what you are hoping, praying for, anticipating.
Yeah, so I'm going to go to Colorado next week. So if you happen to see this and you're in Colorado, you can join me or reach out to me. Then I'm going to go up to Moscow for a week. And then I'm teaching a class, a rhetoric class at NSA. I'll be in there for a couple days. And then I'm going to go over to Washington, Western Washington, drop down to Oregon, and then hopefully drop down to California. And then school kind of ends like in the middle of May, late May. And I'll kind of wrap up my semester. Then I'll be in Moscow for the summer and kind of get ready for another year. That's kind of, yeah, things just all blur. So that's kind of the game plan, is to be in Moscow for the summer. I might go to New York City to preach. Union Square is actually a really fun place to preach. And so I'd like to try to get there for a week or two over the summer. But for the most part, just lay low in Moscow and get ready for another semester.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your New York, if you were going to do the New York preaching and how different that is compared to being on a college campus. I myself have never been to New York.
Yeah, it's pre-COVID. I've not been there since COVID. Pre-COVID, and it's crazy how fast time goes. 2016 was probably one of my favorite months of ministry ever. I'd preach in Union Square every night. I'd go from like 6 to 11. They'd shut down the park. May have been midnight, but they'd shut down the park, and the police was like, hey, I have to leave the park. And I mean, they would just gather in throngs. It was like an amazing summer. And the one thing I liked about it is you had tons of internationals. You'd have international people, you have business people, you have street people. You have all walks of life opposed to just a bunch of 18 to 22 year olds. And so you had, in some ways, better discussion, if that makes sense, because you don't have as much of a mob mentality. You have enough diversity there that it kind of neuters a total mob mentality. You would have the occasional just crazy person that dominates, and there's no reining them in once you lose them, but you have much more of a mob mentality on a college campus. So in some ways, something like Union Square is great. It is a little more difficult, I think, get a good crowd rolling in Union Square than it is on campus. But I haven't been there since COVID, so I don't know what to expect or anything like that. Yeah, I haven't preached. I will say the times I preach on campuses in New York post COVID, loved them. Part of the great things that is honestly tons of Jews. So you kind of have a conversation on the nature of whether or not Jesus is the Messiah. Right now, some of the Israeli Hamas stuff that comes up. I kind of take a pretty neutral, stance because I just simply don't know enough on that issue. So I usually say both sides need Jesus, which is kind of my Jesus juke on them. So anyway, New York, one of the things I do like is you are able to have some of those debates and discussions because there's quite a few Jewish people. You get in the Midwest, you get in the South, not as many Jewish people. And whereas in New York, they're pretty vocal.
Hmm. All right. Well, we will be hoping to see you if you're able to swing through Centralia. We'll try to have you come talk to us in person if we can.
Yeah, I would love to do it. I will be there. I'll definitely keep you posted because I'd love to stop in. I've yet to see your work there. I feel like I met somebody from Centralia, and they were saying how much they liked you. I can't remember what the context was. I wish I remember who it was, but yeah, there were some people in Moscow that maybe not too long ago, because I've been trying to think of my context. It had to be Moscow that I was interacting with somebody. So okay. I look forward to seeing your work and what you guys have going on.
Great. All right. Well, if people want to support you or follow along, where can they find you?
Yes. Campus Preacher on Instagram is kind of an easy one. Keith Darrell on Facebook. Then I have a website, campuspreacher.com. You can go there and there's a contact form if you want to contact me. Like I said, I'm going to be Colorado. Oh, I'm also going to stop in Montana, Colorado, Montana, Washington, down the coast. So if you're anywhere along there, especially like Centralia, I realize it's a little bit far away from like Bellingham. Bellingham's a really fun campus. So if you're in general, so if you're able to join me, it's like you get to see me preach to Antifa in a way. So it's kind of what's amazing to me though is like over the past year there, that campus has been so great. Like so many, like again, those students almost know things are exhausting. You know what I mean? And it's almost like there has to be an alternative. So that's a really fun campus. And then Oregon, maybe I don't even know if one of those would be closer, but Eugene and Corvallis are usually both pretty good campuses as well. So if anybody would ever want to join me, just reach out. I don't always post my schedule because even like real basic things, when I tell people I'm going to come back, oftentimes people take over the area that I'm going to preach in or something like that. And so that way I have to go to it is a little bit like a business where you need a good location. If you don't have a good location, it's really hard to get people's attention. And if people know you're going to come back, they'll often take over the area. So I don't always tell everybody where I'm going to be. Some campuses that doesn't matter. You're still going to be able to get a good crowd going and stuff like that. But feel free to reach out to me anytime. I'll let you know where I'm going to be. And I always like having people join me because I think just the reality, like I've had a pastor join me before and he's like, I just felt like crying the whole time. I didn't realize how dark my city is. You know what I mean? He's just like, the stuff people believe. He's like, I'm just not interacting with that. And I'm kind of hardened at this point where I'm so used to it. We're just like, oh yeah, whatever. Like, of course they're doing that. So my conscience does need to be more sensitive. So I think it does give you a heart for the loss. You just realize like, yeah, these people are outside of Christ really is death. And even if you have children, maybe some of the content you may not think is totally appropriate. But if your kids are tempted with the world, I think just kind of come out, observe kind of the chaos, the moral chaos that ensues once you reject Jesus, I think is almost a fair warning of just being like, to whom else shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. So even children, adults, I think anybody coming out and observing it, again, it's not just because I do it. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but it really is. It's like, it's pretty amazing. Like, people sit around for 3, 4, 5 hours, listen to the gospel, debate a bunch of things that they're not thinking about any other time. And you'll see the very people that we often think, oh, they'll never listen to us. Like, it's always, you know, Luna, Neptune, and all these people, you just assume, oh, they're so far gone. And the reality of it is, like, what we as Christians need to be is like, how can we be hospitable to these people? And they do want answers, and we do have answers, and we do have real healing. We have real healing for real destruction of what we've done with ourselves with sin, what others have done with us to sin. And the answer is, honestly, in all of them, Jesus. And so how do we preach that to people very clearly, graciously, firmly? I'm hopeful from what I've seen in the young people that there's hope for the gospel if we're willing to preach the gospel to them, rather than just like a bare morality, rather than just a right-wing vision of reality. Like, are we really reorienting everything around Jesus? And one last thing, because it's just been kind of central, like 1 Corinthians 1, to the Jews, they want signs and wonders, we preach Christ crucified. The Greeks want wisdom, we preach Christ crucified. Like, are we genuinely preaching Jesus and like making sure that my confession, Jesus Christ is Lord? And it's amazing how much traction, and I believe this, but if I just say, look, I'm not asking you to pledge your allegiance to America. I'm not asking you to pledge your allegiance to the Constitution. Jesus Christ is Lord. Everything else is relativized under him. And so we still have other allegiances, but his Lord, and like, that just gives me so much freedom to talk to a bunch of people that assume I don't want to interact with them. You know what I mean? And it's a pretty mundane, easy layup sort of thing. Like, hopefully every Christian believes, yeah, Jesus is Lord, not the Constitution, not America. So how do we take those basic platitudes, Jesus Lord, not America, God is love, not, you know, whatever we set up, and then from there tease them out in implications. So anyway, I say all that from the standpoint that I think if someone comes out, is able to observe those things, it would even encourage other people to be like, yeah, we should not be afraid of our neighbors who are, you know, out front of their house. They have, in this house, we believe in science and no humans illegal, and just being like, all those are value laden. You know what I mean? Like, it's very clearly a value laden neighbor that's willing to do that. And so how do you go in there and discuss those values with them? And even being willing to give them a bone of just like, here are the things that you believe that are right. Humans do have dignity. You know what I mean? Blah, blah, whatever it is. And just find that point of contact and teasing out, but here's the remedy in the gospel. Anyway, that might be more than you wanted and all that sort of jazz, but anybody can join me anytime.
Great. Well, thanks, Keith. And we'll try to do maybe one more follow-up as you wrap up the school year, and hopefully we can see you in person. So thanks for sharing the time with us.
Yeah.